And welcome to Third Opinion. I'm Mike Deason.
This is Lorene Jaffe.
And we are delighted that you are here with us today. I want to say from the outset, we are not going to be taking any calls today. We'll be reading some letters that people have sent in on the mail. There are some weeks we will take calls when we broadcast live. Other weeks we won't. This is one of the weeks we will not. I know that upsets some people, but that's the deal that we made with the station when we said we're going to do the show. And if you don't like it, there's nothing we can do about it. So I'm sorry about that. Anyhow, just to get that out of the way. Oh, we want to start off with our opening segment, which we call News for Jews. I got to do a jingle for that. We got to get a tacky little jingle.
We do need a little tacky jingle.
I can do that in my home studio. Anyhow, what we want to do is focus on issues and news that's important to the Jewish community. And for those of you who are first turning in or tuning in for the first time, this is a program to talk about issues that are important to the Jewish community in Tampa Bay. A lot of people are going to disagree with us because there are other people who have differing views. That's fine. But that's what this program is all about. If you're angry, send us an email. I'm giving you my personal email. It's deason.media@gmail.com. We will have a third opinion email here at WMNF, but you can send them to me and we'll get them on the air.
Right, and we'll announce that email as soon as we get it. We've asked for it, so we are just waiting for that to be set up.
That's right. Okay, let's start off with an issue that came out this past week that involves Ilhan Omar, who we've got a bunch of things dealing with her. But for those of you who are not aware, she is part of the squad, the four women that have been attacked by the president. But Omar said this week that she's going to introduce legislation that would prohibit any bans of BDS. And she doesn't really say BDS when she says that.
No, she doesn't. You know, it was very subtle in the way she said it, but it was unsubtle. I think the problem I had with it was her utilization of terminology of Nazis and Hitler. And, you know, those of us who knew what she was talking about knew she was talking about BDS, which means she's talking about Israel, which means she's comparing Israel to Nazis and Hitler. And it's the same type of hate rhetoric that we have heard time and time again. And I think this is what's frustrating, is that we're this latest focus. I mean, it seems to be this thing that we've heard over the last 2 to 3 years, and it's increasing. This comparison of Israel to Nazis and Hitler. Everybody wants to use that terminology, and it's really a grotesque, you know, obscene, inappropriate comparison, and it's offensive. And I appreciate that non-Jews maybe don't appreciate just how offensive that type of comparison is.
Yeah, people go back to that all the time, and I don't understand why. Maybe because it's easy.
Yeah, I don't understand it either. It's just this, it's the, you know, something about the far left and the utilization of Nazis and Hitler as a comparison. If everyone is a Nazi, everyone is acting like Hitler. And when you, and I feel like it does a disservice to the history and to the Holocaust again. We've had these conversations about, it's almost like this desensitizing of the younger generation that doesn't necessarily appreciate what the Holocaust was.
But I also, though, think the far right, too. I don't think we can limit this to the far left. I think of, again, I go back to Charlottesville, which was again, a slap.
The neo-Nazis, absolutely.
So it's, you can't just look in the far left and say they're the ones. I mean, the far right is doing that, too. And the far right is, to me, more frightening because they are the ones that have been behind all of the attacks, whether it be at synagogues or mosques, right, or any other mass shooting.
Right, and there's a reason why we have security at our synagogues. There's a reason why we have armed guards at, you know, the JCCs and different things. It's because there are these hate groups out there that actually do act on their rhetoric, which is violent. I mean, you know, so it's twofold. I mean, I think it's both sides. I think there's this concern of desensitizing the next generation of the Holocaust. But yeah, I mean, the neo-Nazis and their, I guess, you know, this new increase in visibility or just being so audacious, they just feel empowered. That's very frightening for members of the Jewish community.
It is. And that resolution, by the way, was co-sponsored by Representative Rashida Tlaib, who is one of the squad members, and also Representative John Lewis of Georgia, which sort of surprised me because he stands up for civil rights. He was an icon in the civil rights movement, but they seek to oppose unconstitutional legislative efforts to limit the use of boycotts to further civil rights at home and abroad. And most folks don't think this is going to go anywhere.
I don't think it's going to go anywhere. There is another resolution, I think, on the House floor right now that is supported by the majority of both sides, Republicans and Democrats, that actually condemns BDS and recognizes it for what it is. And I, you know, the comments I thought, what I thought was most interesting about the whole story really was just the support for Israel in response, even from members of the Democratic Party, in response to the Congresswoman's proposal, like Representative Brad Sherman, the Democrat from California, who is a known progressive in California. He said, "I can't imagine that any committee is going to mark up or take seriously any pro-BDS resolution. Am I worried about the overall BDS movement worldwide as an economic matter? No. As an effort to delegitimize Israel, of course. The comments here today are a tiny part of that delegitimizing effort." Those were pretty strong words by Representative Sherman. And, you know, but we saw this from several representatives in the House on both sides of the aisle that had a strong response to that. So I think that to me is what really caught my attention about the whole thing.
And what also to me was encouraging, she said she wants to visit Israel.
Well, she and Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib also, they both said that, I mean, even before I think they were elected, that they wanted to visit Israel, but And I don't know what that means and what it would look like. I know initially they wanted to go there, but they just wanted to go to the West Bank, to Ramallah, and they actually did not want to go into the state of Israel. They didn't want to go. So
hopefully they will.
Right. I hope so. I think it's, you know, you just got to go spend time and meet people and talk to people and educate yourself. I think that's the most important thing. And we heard that even from callers, you know, saying comments like, "Oh, I would never go there." Well, then, you know, if you never go there, if you never challenge yourself, how do you really know the truth? Go look, talk to people, talk to Palestinians, talk to Jews, talk to the Christians, talk to people, see what life is like on a daily basis. Let them tell you their story. I think that's important.
And while I hate what she says, I defend her right to say it.
Absolutely.
And unfortunately, though, this week, the president seemed to say that the four members of the squad, again, don't have the right to criticize the government, to speak freely. There is nothing more American to me than to be able to criticize your government. That's what we fought the wars for, and it just is incredible to me that the president would say send her back and talk about all four of them when three of the four were born in the United States.
Right. Well, you know, I think nothing ever surprises us when Trump tweets. I think it was properly condemned by people on both sides of the aisle and across the board. I think that was very important. I mean, we want to be able to, you know, I want her to express her views. I think that's important. It doesn't mean I have to agree with them. It doesn't mean that they're right, but let her express them, that it is a free country. Thank God. Let's keep it that way.
It reminds me, because I'm a little bit older than you are, of the Vietnam War. I was in college in the 60s, and there were lots of protests, and they called the hippie freaks, and they said, love it or leave it, and that, you know, if you criticize America, if you criticize the war, you don't belong in this country. And ultimately what happened is the people protesting the war were able to end the war that was clearly going nowhere. But it was a very similar feeling for anybody who was in college that was my age, right, at that time in the 60s. It reminds me that I was pleased to see so many Jewish leaders, right, came out and said that these four Congress members had the right to say this. Now, not all. Now, the Republican Jewish Coalition, which is a really conservative group, says it agreed with a comment by Senator Lindsey Graham saying the Democratic congresswomen are a bunch of communists. They hate Israel. They hate their own country. They may hate Israel. I don't know. They certainly talk disparagingly about Israel, but I don't think they hate the United States. I really don't.
I mean, look, none of us really know what's in their hearts and what is their true intentions. I mean, I think that there is an element of hate that was taught, and because and I understand Congresswoman Rashid Tlaib. She's a Palestinian, and there is that she does have, you know, whether you want to call it hate or anger or whatever it is. I mean, she clearly, and you know, because she is very much colored by and very much involved in that environment, that situation. She has family that's over there. So, and you know, what we see even with Representative Omar, you know, a lot of the Muslim countries, you know, the word Jew is a dirty word. So growing up in those countries, you are hearing Jews as being dirty, evil things, you know, and you're hearing that. And it's whether or not you realize it, it is laying this foundation that's coloring your view. But I would say this about Representative Omar. I encourage her to continue. You know, she said that she wanted to learn and be educated. And I, you know, continue to encourage that. I think that's important. I think it's important that we not ostracize her, but that we continue to reach out and try to educate and try to learn from each other.
And on the final thing on this, I was just shocked. Richard Spencer, who is a crazy right-wing instigator, I would say, said that he thought that the president's tweets didn't go far enough. Now, Spencer, if you don't know, is a neo-Nazi.
Right, whack job.
And is a really, really dangerous guy. There was 2 years ago, he tried to speak at the University of Florida.
Florida, yes.
And that caused all sorts of problems there. Closer to home, Nikki Fried, who we had on this show a couple of weeks ago, who is the Secretary of Agriculture and is Jewish, lashed out at Senator Rick Scott because he called the Democratic Party anti-Semitic.
Right. And I agree with her frustration with that. Look, I think, and Nikki even said it herself, I mean, she is the only Democrat that is a member of the cabinet in the state of Florida, one of the most important states for a presidential election. And she made a point in making her first mission as a cabinet member, going to Israel and taking a very clear stand and saying that I, a Democrat, and the Democrats of the state of Florida stand with Israel. And that she was sending a very clear message that the Democratic Party is not anti-Semitic. And I agree with her. I don't believe that the Democratic Party is anti-Semitic. I think that was a right response by her.
79% of American Jews identify themselves as Democrats, so that's just a political trope that is trying to divide the Jewish community, and I don't appreciate it either by Senator Scott. Did you see the story about a call to kill Jews
by the Hamas? Yes, Hamas.
There's a worldwide call. It says, all of you 7 million abroad, enough of the warming up. You have Jews everywhere, and we must attack every Jew on the globe by way of slaughter and killing, if God permits.
Well, he said, all of you 7 million Palestinians abroad.
Abroad, yeah.
So, you know, and this is what we saw. I mean, look, what I thought was the most interesting, and he's a member of the Hamas cabinet, was that there were a couple of Palestinian leaders and figures that came out and sort of separated themselves from that statement, saying this isn't, you know, that's not Hamas's platform. Well, the reality is it is Hamas's platform. I mean, when you look at what Hamas's platform is to rid, you know, that land of the Jews. I mean, they're very clear about that. They don't hide that.
Well, we played those tapes last week,
right,
teaching kids to kill the Jews. That
exactly
was sponsored by Hamas, that was on television every single day.
Right. So Hamas is a member of the Muslim Brotherhood. And we all know the Muslim Brotherhood was created back in the 1920s. And why? For two reasons. They wanted to rid pretty much the Middle East, the land that is known as Israel now, and Northern Africa of the Jews, and of what they considered the European colonizers, right?
Yeah.
So that, you know, and this that hasn't changed. I mean, the Muslim Brotherhood, that's still their intention. That's why Hezbollah, you know, has 100,000 plus rockets on the northern border of Israel, targeting Israel to wipe Israel off the face of the earth any day. That's why Hamas is in constant war with Israel. It's this, you know, you look at Iran and just, this is why that is their platform. So, I think he was just saying what was obvious, what we already knew. I guess they just didn't like the media attention. And so they're like, oh, we're going to back off that.
Well. And to show that we're hated universally through many parts of the world, former members of the Waffen-SS are attending meetings of the far right extremists to hold talks about their wartime experiences and to talk about Hitler Youth. I think they're trying to have a resurgence of Hitler Youth in Germany and throughout all of Europe. It's tough to be Jewish in Europe these days.
Right. Well, you know, that's why you see the mass exodus of Jews in France and other countries. I mean, especially France, which had the largest Jewish population in modern day, you know, making Aliyah and emigrating to Israel because it's the only safe place they can go. I mean, and we'll hear that later today on our show with the story we're going to talk about with the Mizrahi Project and the Mizrahi Jews and how, you know, they're so grateful for Israel because they have a safe place to go where they are not going to be in a difficult situation. So, you know, whether they're facing, you know, Muslim Brotherhood or they're facing these By the way, I didn't even understand how the Waffen-SS, like, you know, you've
well,
got
these
the
are old guys.
This is crazy. It's like the German Domestic Security Agency identified this. Like, why are these guys not arrested? Why are they not prosecuted? I don't care how old they are. They should be sitting in prison. Let them rot the last few days of their lives away in prison. Like, what the heck? I can't curse, so I just...
Yeah, you ought to have a little more passion, Lorene.
No. I mean, but like, seriously, if the German government knows these guys are doing this, why are these guys not behind bars?
I know.
It's just an obvious question. Why? Let them rot away in jail.
No, I agree with you. Okay, all right.
Disgusting.
On a happier note, as we all take a deep breath and say, it's Emmy season again, and Jews in the TV industry have plenty to celebrate. The nominations came out. Some of the Jewish people who are in the shows that got nominations, The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. Have you seen that?
No, you know what? I have not. I've had friends who have totally binge-watched it and have told me to watch it. They keep saying, you know, so I've got to find time to binge-watch, but I've heard amazing things about it.
Yeah, it really is. Rachel Bronson was nominated for the Best Comedy Actress. Tony Shalhoub got a nod. Maren Hinkle and Alex Borenstein were nominated. Okay, some other Jewish people. Russian Doll, about a Jewish New Yorker named Nadia Volkov, who finds her in a pickle a la Groundhog Day, got a nod for Best Comedy. Natasha Leon, Eugene Levy and Catherine O'Hara both got nominated for, I don't know if I can say this on the air. I didn't mean to leave it, but I'll say it as with the C, Chitts Creek, but that's not how they say it. It's actually a very funny show.
Exactly.
But Patricia Arquette, whose mother was Jewish, I didn't know that.
Oh, really? Oh,
yeah. I didn't know that. It was nominated for a role in Escape at Dannemora. Jewish comedian Sarah Silverman, who I think is just hysterical. I Love You, America with Sarah Silverman was nominated. Maya Rudolph, whose father is Jewish, that I did know.
Yeah, I watched the, you know when you do the that one show where they're looking at where you came from, the heredity?
Yeah.
She did it. She did the DNA and the whole thing. It was a really cool story.
Wow.
So I enjoyed that. Sarah Goldberg also, for a nod for Best Supporting Actress. That show with Sally Reed.
That's a pretty funny show, too. It's sort of dark.
And Adam Sandler, and
I love Adam Sandler.
He was nominated for Best Guest Actor in the comedy series for hosting Saturday Night Live. Amy Schumer.
Who's Chuck Schumer's cousin, by the way. Did you know that?
Oh, I did not know that.
Yes, she is
really?
Senator Chuck Schumer's cousin.
Small world, wow.
Really? So you learned something on
that. Interesting. Sacha Baron Cohen.
Yeah.
He's being nominated. There's just lots of good things going on in the Jewish world.
Right.
And things to be happy about and proud about, you know. So it's not all bad news.
No, it's not. Okay, and that's now. Here's where the jingle comes in. That's the news for Jews. We got to get. I'll work on the jingle. What we're going to do is take a little break. We've got lots more coming. Stay with us, and we'll be right back. This is the Third Opinion on WMNF 88.5. listening to The Third Opinion on WMNF 88.5. I am Mike Deason.
And this is Laureen Jaffe.
Okay, Laureen, let's talk about the Mizrahi Project a little bit.
Oh, yes, the Mizrahi Jewish Project. So this is an amazing thing. This was a project that's done by a Christian man, an African-American pastor from California. And we're going to have him on live to talk about it and why he was driven to do it. But you can look at it's. I think it's a MizrahiProject.org or something like that on the internet.
Yeah, just Google Mizrahi Project.
And he had, because I saw him live. He was in town in January, and I went to go see him do a live discussion on the Mizrahi Project. And it really came about because he had a neighbor who was a Mizrahi Jew, and he had never heard about their stories about all the Jews throughout the Middle East and Northern Africa that had lived there for hundreds of years, if not thousands of years, in the case of Iran, Iraq, and Morocco, that had been, in essence, kicked out of those countries with nothing but the clothes on their back in the early 1900s, you know, around the Holocaust time and then post. And so he just felt compelled to share their story, and so he compiled a diary of these of interviews, which I love, of people telling their stories or of the stories of their family members and how they had to leave those countries and start all over again, but yet they still had this great love for those countries, whether it was Morocco or Libya or Iran, Iraq. So, but just it was special. It was very special listening to these stories.
So what we want to do is play one of the stories for you. This is a story of Joseph Samuels, who was born in Iran, and then he emigrated to Israel, and this is his story, Joseph Samuels.
My family that were able to smuggle out, that was me in this corner here, and the picture is my father and my mother, my 3 years older brother, Yaakov. My Arabic name is Yusuf. I was born in Baghdad in 1930. So in the 30s, anti-Semitism began to grow. We brought up not to challenge a Muslim. If somebody says bad word to you, don't challenge, because it will become worse to the Jews. The Muslim mobs went into the rampage, looting and murdering Jews. He said in Arabic, the name is Farhud. In English, translated as a violent disposition. They stopped the minibuses. We didn't have big buses, all it was minibuses. Singled out the Jewish passengers. They robbed the men, they slaughtered them. They raped the women, and they threw the babies in the river. I was frightened, but my older brother didn't say anything. They said, it's okay, don't worry, everything is okay. But I knew there's something wrong. With this persecution worse, we left. I succeeded to smuggle out from Baghdad to Iran. The smugglers take one of these boats and made a false room, 10 feet by 10 feet and 2.5 feet, and they covered it with hay. So we were 16 of us in that room. We stayed overnight in that tributary river, and we stayed the whole day hiding in that dark room. And from Iran, I went to Israel. When I arrived, I kissed the ground, and I smelled freedom of fresh air. In the 40s, in Iraq, there was 135,000 Jews living. In Baghdad, there was about 90,000. Today, there's none. When I arrived, I went to the refugee camps, but we never stayed because we looked for the future. Whenever we settled, we became part of the country, whether US, England, Europe. We are proud to be part of this country, the citizens. We don't live as a victim. Living as a victim is a miserable life.
And they refused to live as a victim. Now, what an amazing story that is.
Oh, that story and so many of them, you heard that time and time again of these families. Just said, we were refugees. But we're not going to live like victims. We're going to move forward. And how important Israel was for each one of those individuals or families that were interviewed, just the idea that there was a safe place where Jews could go where they wouldn't be, you know, less than full citizens. This whole idea of many of them living under the Dhimmi laws, which meant, you know, in a lot of the, and, you know, under Sharia law, that they were treated as less than, you know, 100% human or full citizens.
When I heard about them hiding underneath in that cramped quarters, I thought of a story of my great aunt who was living in Poland during the Holocaust. Her first husband and son were shot one day. It was Kill the Jews Day. Remarried the man that I only knew as my Uncle Paul, and a German family, somehow they got to Germany, hid Jews in their barn underneath, and in the, they could only come out at night. Their son was in the German army, came home on leave, led Jews across the Alps to safety.
Wow.
And then they made it to Israel.
Wow.
And then they came to the United States in 1955. But I mean, just the thought that a German family would risk their lives and their son would risk their lives. There were a lot of wonderful people who did that. But let's talk about, I sort of got sidetracked, but that was such a moving story to me about living like that and trying to make it to Israel.
Yeah, the escape, absolutely. So we have with us on the line Dusami Washington, the one who actually put together the Mizrahi Project, and he's the one who worked on collecting these interviews and putting this together for us, which I'd encourage every one of our listeners to go on and listen to these stories. It really is extraordinary hearing about Jewish life in these vibrant communities throughout all of Northern Africa and the Middle East. So with that,
Dusami, you with us? I hear him on the phone there. Why are we not hearing him?
Wait, hold on.
Hold on. We're having a technical difficulty.
Wasn't there a button?
No, we got the button on. We got the phone on.
I thought there was a button over here.
You think there's a button over here? Okay. Well.
All right. Hold on 1 second. We're working on it.
Okay. Now, which button do you think we need to push over here? I honestly don't know. Now, I don't think it's that one. Well, we had it on the air before. Why can't we get this on the air? Obviously, we're having a technical difficulty. Here's what we're going to do. I've got another story from the Mizrahi Project. Let me play that, and we're going to figure out how to get the phone on the air right now. It's our fault. It's some kind of technical difficulty, but we're going to figure this out. Hang with us. And here's another story of a man who's in America now, but emigrated from Morocco.
Well, this is actually my first issue as editor-in-chief of the Jewish Journal, and I called my good friend Rabbi Daniel Buskila, one of the great Sephardic Jews of Los Angeles, and he did a whole cover for us on the holiday of Sukkot, the magic of Sukkot. I was born in a little village right outside of Casablanca called Bereshit. Ethnicity and culture goes very deep. My mother speaks Arabic. When you come to our weddings and bar mitzvahs, there's lots of Arabic music. So as much as we are connected to our Jewish identity, there was a real deep connection with Moroccan culture. After the destruction of the Second Temple, we were the first Jews in Morocco, and we populated the south of Morocco. So we were way before the Inquisition of 1492. From what I hear today in Morocco, there are less than 3,000 Jews. So it went from a high of 300,000 to 3,000. Most of them are concentrated in Casablanca and Marrakesh. You have to remember that we were Dhimmis. Dhimmis are subjects, if you will, second-class citizens. And that's helped us get along for centuries, is we accepted our role as second-class citizen. And that enabled us to have a decent relationship with the Arabs because they never saw us as a threat. I think the reason you see discrepancy in terms of how Arab countries treat their Jews, really it starts from the top. And what are they teaching their people? The reason Israel is important to me connects directly to my grandfather. In 1952, he emigrated to Israel. They sort of smuggled him out. And if you're religious, then you're praying three times a day. And every time you pray, there's something in the prayer that connects you back to Zion, to Israel. and that after 18 centuries of praying and yearning, then he sort of, 1948, it happened. So I could see him being real excited. And then he kissed the ground and said, I'm never leaving. And he never complained. So that's been part of my family narrative, is a grandfather who left everything he had in Casablanca, came home and was grateful to be back home. I'm very moved by the fact that I live in a generation where all the Jews of the world are going through a type of family reunion. Because the truth is that my ancestors in Morocco probably never met an Ashkenazi Jew. So for centuries, they lived with their own kind. And all of a sudden, here in this generation, I'm meeting Jews from Russia, from Poland, from Yemen, from Syria, from everywhere. So I love the fact that my Ashkenazi friends are learning about the Jews of Arabia, the Jews of the Levant, the Jews of North Africa. And it works both ways.
So we think we have figured out our technical problem. And Lorraine was right. There was a button that I did not push that we were supposed to push. So we should be okay right now.
Right. So no one paid attention. So hopefully, Dumisani Washington, I hope you're with us this time. Are you?
Yeah, my wife helps me push all the right buttons. So I completely get it. When she's not there, I'm kind of not sure what to do, so I completely understand.
I apologize for keeping you hanging on so long. We're in a studio that we're just getting used to. It's not our normal studio, but there are a lot of buttons here. But we've got you. That's the important thing, how it all works out.
Sir. Yes, exactly.
Yes,
so,
sir. No problem.
So first of all, let me just apologize earlier because I think I mispronounced your name, but it's Dumisani Washington, and we are really thrilled to have you with us. So this was, we listened to two interviews that you were able to gather as part of this project. And so a lot of people are probably asking why. So would you maybe share a little bit about yourself, you know, who you are and why you did this?
Sure. So again, I'm Dumisani Washington. I am the National Diversity Outreach Coordinator for Christians United for Israel. Christians United for Israel. Started by John Hagee in San Antonio, Texas, about 14 years ago with 400 pastors, is now over 7 million members. It's the largest, most ethnically diverse pro-Israel organization in the country. And the Mizrahi story, the Jews of North Africa and the Middle East, is something that I was introduced to years ago before I was on staff with CUFI by a dear friend who is actually a Mizrahi Jew. Her name is Rachel Waba. She lives in San Francisco, near where I live, out there in Northern California. And we happened to find each other online. I was doing some advocacy work for Israel. And so for me, background, I grew up in the United States, grew up in a very, I call it a black Zionism. I'm from a traditional kind of black Baptist upbringing as a Christian. And so there was not a lot of talk about Israel as a state, but a lot of the scriptural references and everything. There was always this identification between the black struggle for freedom and what the Jews went through. I mean, the greatest abolitionist and during that time was Harriet Tubman, and her nickname was Moses. So there was always those types of connections that were there. So I was always fascinated with the Jewish story, always fascinated with everything from the ancient story of the scriptures to today, and then the diaspora, the Jews of Ethiopia, the Jews of India, Burma. But I had never heard of the Jews from the region. Of course, the region from which they're from, Africa, the Middle East, from Iraq and Iran, and from Egypt, from Syria, Algeria, and Yemen, and on and on. So as I learned that story several years ago, it just kind of captivated me. Once I became a staff member with CUFI, one of the things that we do is not just continue to reach out to the multi-ethnic church, but also tell the story of Israel, parts of the story that's often not told. And this was one that over 850,000 Jewish refugees from North Africa and the Middle East forced to flee their homelands. The vast majority of them, over 650,000 of them, wind up becoming citizens of Israel. Even today, the majority of Israel's Jewish population is actually from North Africa and the Middle East. There's a smaller population, of course, of the Holocaust survivors who fled. But again, most people don't know that the Jews of Israel, most of them are actually from that region.
You know, I think that part of what your project exposes is the need for an Israel. We've heard from people, and obviously you must be aware there are critics of Israel throughout the world who say, why do you need a Jewish state? Why in the world does Israel have to exist? Mm-hmm. To me, this drives it home so much.
Yes, yes. Well, what we often say in the advocacy, and we do this with our young people as well as just in general within CUFI, because even right now I'm traveling, I meet with pastors and leaders, and we talk about this work and continue to have Christians stand in solidarity with Israel and the Jewish people. We often say that the terms that are often used to describe Israel and the Jewish people would not be used with anybody else. For example, as you just said, the right to exist. No one would say Kenya doesn't have the right to exist. No one would say Japan doesn't have the right to exist. But somehow, because of how Israel has been demonized as a modern state over the past decades, particularly after the 1967 war, this is something that has to be contended. As we know, the boycott, divestment, and sanctions plot of Israel's enemies are to really marginalize the state and hopefully destroy the state. That is what the actual goal is. Even those who are involved in the movement will say that they want there to be a Palestine from the river to the sea. So Israel then, as a state, if I tell the young people all the time, when they stand up and say, I have the right to exist, no one else is being required to say that. And you're absolutely right. The Jewish people from that region, for example, it kind of boggles our mind. Here they are fighting a war for their existence. We know May 14, 1948, they declare independence. The very next day, the Arab world attacks the Jewish state. And so Israel is immediately defending its right to exist while it is receiving literally hundreds of thousands of refugees from the region. So over the first few years, Israel is both fighting and also setting up refugee camps. If you look at those old pictures of Tel Aviv, you'll see tents that are there that are spread out as far as the eye can see because Jews are coming from Yemen and from Morocco and other places. They're fighting a war and also receiving their own brothers and sisters from these other places. And just miraculously, not only do they survive, Israel thrives today.
Well, so tell us a little bit about the interviewees. I mean, I listened personally to, I think, every single one that was available on the website and listened to the stories. How did you go about identifying them and going through that whole process of that discussion and sharing with them? I'm certain they must have been surprised that somebody wanted to tell their story, but what did you do? How did you find these people?
Well, the way that it got started was, again, my friend Rachel Waba, she's also, not only she's an advocate, not only she talks about the Jews from North Africa and the Middle East, she's also a member of an organization called Jimena, J-I-M-E-N-A, which stands for Jews Indigenous to the Middle East and North Africa. They are based there in San Francisco. Again, I live in Northern California, right outside, about an hour and a half from San Francisco. So as I met Rachel, I also met most of the staff that's there. Gina Waldman is the founder of Jimena. Sarah Levine is the executive director. And so we became friends, and it was a situation where I'm learning so much from the community, and I began to advocate with them. Again, this was before I was on staff with CUFI. Once I was on staff, we began to do it that way as well. So we had this idea for the Mizrahi Project. Of course, I went to them. I shared it with them, and I'll tell you something interesting, what happened with our Iranian Jewish friends down there in L.A., but I shared it with them. They provided for us members of their organizations to interview. We simply said, hey, guys, we want to be able to do it from different countries, Iraq, Syria, can you help us? And they would contact their own members, and then they would connect us. And it's not far to say, it's not a stretch to say at all, if it were not for the cooperation of Jimena, our own Jewish friends, our Mizrahi Jewish friends, the Mizrahi Project really would not exist like it does. It is simply because they were willing to help us help them tell their story, and we are forever indebted to them. And I'll say this one last thing. The Iranian Jewish community as well, they introduced me to them. I went down to L.A. to talk with the leaders there to share with them the story. And I share the story often. I'll make this very short. It breaks my heart, but it just shows me. It was kind of illustrative for me. I shared with them what we were doing, what CUFI was getting ready to do in launching this video project. And they literally, they sat there and they looked at me for a while. It was like time for Q&A. And it was dead silent in the room. I wasn't sure what was going on. And then finally someone asked, you want to tell our story? And I said, yeah. And I said, okay, I'm not sure what's happening here. I said, yeah. They said, why? Why do you want to tell our story? I said, well, for Christians, it's the Bible come to life. I mean, the Jews from Iran or the Jews of Persia, that's all the whole Esther story. And the Jews from Iraq, that's Babylon. That's the Daniel story. I mean, this is like for us, I'm like, wow, the modern state of Israel is this fulfillment of God's promise. And then they said to me, no one wants to hear our story. And this was a theme that I would hear throughout, that what they would, sometimes they were silent, they would share the stories, but they had become so accustomed to being ignored by the broader society. In other words, and this was not in any way a competition to the Jews of Europe who were expelled, and many of your people already know if they're listening, Hitler had also launched persecution of the Jews in North Africa. There were concentration camps in Libya. He was well aware of the Mizrahi community. This is something else that's not discussed very much. He was well on his way to destroy those Jews as well. And so they were saying that they were used to not really being listened to. They weren't being really heard. And I have some theories as to why that would happen, particularly because one of the things that we know about this story is that when you tell the Mizrahi story, when you tell the story of the Jews of the Holocaust, you have to tell the story of who the nemesis was, which was Hitler and the Nazi Party. Unfortunately, though, when you tell the story of the Mizrahi being cast out of the region there, you then also have to tell the story of Arab Muslim imperialism. That doesn't mean that it's a swipe or an attack on the Muslim world or the Arab Muslim world at all, but it does let you know who it was that actually organized it. The Grand Mufti of Jerusalem was actually a cohort of Adolf Hitler, and so they coordinated their efforts. The Farhuds that happened in Iraq in the early 1940s, that came as a result of the meeting that he had with Hitler. And sometimes it's politically incorrect to say, well, there was a Nazi mentality there as well that persecuted Jews in the Arab Muslim lands.
Well, I've got to tell you, the audio is engaging, but to watch the video in my real life when I'm not here on the radio, I'm also a documentary filmmaker, so I can appreciate the beauty of the videos that you put together. They're really well done and moving, and I would encourage people to try to go and see them. And that's when I ask you, where do they find you guys on the web? Where can they see all these wonderful, wonderful videos? And how can they get involved if they want to know more about this project?
Absolutely. They can go on the website. The way to start it, to go on the website, The Mizrahi. And Mizrahi is MIZRAHI Project, themizrahiproject.org. When you go there, you will find the videos there. And I have to say that the beauty of I share that with you. I'm in awe of them. My good friend Raj Nair, he's actually the director. Raj actually works with Israel Collective, which is our millennial group, and he's also the producer of our television show called The Watchmen, featuring Eric Steckelbeck. He and Dan, these guys are amazing. They actually won an award for one of their films, which is about the cult called The School of Peace. I encourage anybody to go there as well. Go to IsraelCollective.org, and you can find it as well. So if you go to the MizrahiProject.org, on our page there, we are on, of course, on the Internet, but also on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. The films are there and on YouTube. I encourage anyone listening, this is how you can be active in this story, sharing these stories with your friends, with your constituents. If your pastors or rabbis that are listening, share them with your parishioners. Share these and let them see. They're all the films, as you all already know, it's about 3 minutes long. Again, they're beautifully done. I love looking at them as well. Again, I had no hand in that whatsoever. I kind of put the project together. They made it work. The beauty of it that's there is Raj and Dan. And so absolutely. And we're also working on a compilation where they can see all the films together. We're hopefully going to be doing that within the next month.
Yeah, there's a real good piece called The Millennials and Why They Got Involved. And you see Raj, you see everybody that's involved. Being a filmmaker, that one reached out to me. But it's very cool, even if you're not doing films, to see their passion and why they're doing this.
It was important to us that the stories, which are powerful in and of themselves, but that the story, and I'll just tell you that when we did them, we didn't know how exactly. I let those guys kind of run with it because Raj and Dan are amazing. And when they began to send them to me, they were very, very powerful. But part of my concern was that we had condensed these amazing stories to 3 minutes. And of course, we did in the modern age. We want people to look on their phones, on their iPads. So when I began to share them with our Mizrahi friends, those who had been interviewed, I wanted to see how they felt. They were so touched, and I was relieved because I didn't, again, I don't want them to feel that the story was in any way being cheapened because it was so short. But at the same time, we were wanting the people to get it and grasp it. If you know, as you go on the website, you'll get a full bio of the person. You click on that person's video, and you can get much more information about their story and also a link to Jemina so you can go to see the work that they are doing as well. And so, no, we were very excited, and we were glad that they were pleased with it as well.
Well, Dumi Sani Washington, thank you so much for joining us today. We greatly appreciate your time, and we absolutely enjoyed those videos.
Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Hope we'll have you on again another time. And we're going to take a little break here, and we'll be right back. And we'll get some of your letters and emails to us and some other things. This is The Third Opinion on WMNF 88.5. Welcome back. You're listening to The Third Opinion on WMNF 88.5. I'm Mike Deason.
I'm Lorene Jaffe.
And, you know, one of the things I want to say before we get to some of the emails, people have said to us, Third Opinion, well, there's only two of you. Where's The Third Opinion? The oldest joke in Judaism is two Jews, three opinions.
Exactly. Or sometimes even more.
Even more, yeah. Today, so, Lorene and I are agreeing on everything. We don't always agree on everything. Today, we're pretty much in agreement on everything that we have going on here. We have had some emails from folks. There are folks that are upset with this program that think we are dead wrong. People who have told us on the phone and in emails, they don't think that Israel has the right to exist. We strenuously disagree. Why don't we read a couple of the emails that we received after last week's program?
Right. So we have quite a few from Daniel Callaghan. I think I'm saying the last name right. Daniel Callaghan also happens to be a member of the Florida Peace Action Network, which believes Israel's a racist state. So beginning with that point, Daniel, you and I are going to disagree. So you wrote on July 14th. So these are some of your comments I think you provided to us when we were on air last Sunday live. You said, you know why BDS is targeting Israel and not other pariah nations? Because the world expects more from Israel because it is Jewish. Well, I agree. I think Israel is always held to a higher standard on everything. And I don't know that that's necessarily fair.
It's sort of like the Hebrew National hot dog spot where they say we have to appeal to a higher power.
Right. I mean, literally. I mean, they gotta appease and please everybody. You know, no other nation on earth is held to the same standard
but
as Israel.
I don't understand why that because you say it has to be held to a higher standard, that legitimizes BDS. That makes no sense.
Targeting Israel, right. So why I don't understand the justification and the comments. So maybe you'll provide some more feedback for us, Dan, so we'll help us understand where you're coming from on that.
Right, right.
So let's see. This is PJ Plastino. State of Israel didn't exist when the Nazis held power in Germany, so I don't know who Hitler could have used them as a target. So, and then it cuts off. And then it goes also to add with that rather lame BDS rant, does the host actually listen to those folks or just cherry pick? We just take the callers as they come in, so there's no cherry picking involved.
Right, and let me point out last week when we had someone who was pro our show, we sort of cut him off right. So we could get more negative calls, people who were upset with us. We want to give people an opportunity to say what they feel, even though we disagree with them and might think they're wrong.
Right. So PJ had a couple comments, a few more. He said, all of your responses to folks' genuine comments is to throw
Wait, but you're the lawyer. Isn't that a legal term?
Not a legal term. I would ever use tuquoque. Straw man, non sequiturs, and whataboutism, and this is nothing but fallacious nonsense. Well, I guess we're going to disagree on that, and we all get to have our opinions because that's our First Amendment right.
When you hit the desk, it sort of reverberates. I just want to tell you.
Right. Let's see. Oh, here's another one from Daniel Callaghan. Typed this in Bing, pulled up 1.3 million hits. How is Hamas all Palestinians and right-wing Jews, not all Israeli Jews, Dan? And I'm not sure what he attached. I'm not seeing an attachment there. Then, let's see. This is, I don't know. Look at that one.
That one doesn't make any sense.
Look, Dan Callaghan again. Thank you, Dan, for all your comments. So Daniel Callaghan again. Mike talked about the principal who said the Holocaust didn't occur. Lorene kept speaking as though he's still the principal. Big difference. We were talking about the story,
and he got removed just a day or two beforehand. It made no difference. This one said, you got your butts handed to you, good luck. So they thought that the callers bested us, is what I thought. I didn't think so, but okay, if that's the thing. Listen, if you want to, and we are going to do another live show with phone calls in the next week or two, a couple of weeks. My personal email, deeson@media.com, or you can send some of the WMNF here. Lorene?
Right, so then we had another caller, I guess it was the last caller of the show, who was asking us about the nuclear non-proliferation treaty, which we have never discussed on the show, but it sounds like, so I found an article from August of 2016, and it concerns a lawsuit filed by the Institute for Research Middle Eastern Policy, and it was on the exact issue. In fact, I think some of the language from this article that was actually in the Times of Israel, dated August 12, 2016, was quoted by the caller. So the Institute for Research in Middle Eastern Policy, which I obviously Googled and I went to their website, happens to be a very anti-Israel organization.
Not a surprise.
I'm not going to comment on their lawsuit or on this organization. I didn't really see anything valid in what they were saying, but that's it. So I don't really have anything else to say in response to your inquiry about the lawsuit.
Well, but it sounded to you and to me as if he was reading straight
from that article or from a lawsuit piece, right?
Right.
Now that I've read this.
But quite candidly, last week when he called, we didn't know enough about that issue to comment intelligently or any other way for that matter. But we really do want to hear from you, even if you disagree with us. We wouldn't mind hearing from you if you agree with what we're doing. But we are here as a voice for the Jewish community. And I think that we are serving what we're supposed to be doing here.
Right, exactly. That's what we're responsible for.
That's
what we're trying to do. So anyway, I hope you enjoyed today's show. I hope you all get to check out the Mizrahi Project. I certainly learned quite a bit.
Me too. And I'm sorry for the technical difficulties. Blame it all on me. I take the blame. Lorene said, push that button. But I didn't. But we got it straight out. Anyhow, we'll be back next week, same time, same station. This is The Third Opinion. I'm Mike Deason.
Lorene Jaffe.
Have a great one.
Thank you.
You're listening to WMNF Tampa. I'm Joy Katzen-Guthrie. Welcome to the Sunday Simcha.
Hallelujah, et Adonai min ha-shamayim. Hallelujah, ba-merumim. Hallelujah, chol malachav. Hallelujah, kol tzeva'av. Hallelujah, shemesh ve-yareach. Hallelujah, kol kochvei-or. Hallelujah, shmei ha-shamayim ve-amayim. Asher me'al ha-shamayim.